From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the disconnect between politicians' campaign promises and the reality of the 21st century economy.
Well, I think you get a lot of people talking to particularly blue-collar audiences and saying, you know, we're going to bring jobs back. We're going to essentially go back to the future, and the future's not coming back.
Detroit worker unions supporting Proposal B over the grassroots community benefit Proposal A.
If you put something in place that actually stops the development, there is no community benefit.
And the National Writers Series of Traverse City celebrates its 100th author interview.
We've had all these authors come through. It's not happening anywhere else in the U.S., and it's only because Traverse City is supporting us.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A Community Benefits Ordinance, or CBO. It would require developers who get public support, like tax breaks, for their projects to provide certain benefits to the community: jobs, affordable housing, environmental protections. Detroit's Proposal A, known as the People's CBO, came from a grassroots push from a petition drive. It calls for developers to provide community benefits if their projects have a public and or private investment of more than $15 million, or if they're getting a tax break from the city of at least $300,000. Proposal B was put forth by Detroit City Councilman Scott Benson. It would require developers to provide community benefits for projects worth at least $75 million or tax breaks of at least $1 million. Prop A would bar the council and other city officials from having direct involvement in choosing the community representatives for the neighborhood advisory groups, the people who would negotiate with the developers. And residents could pursue legal action if deals are not upheld. Among opponents of Proposal A is my next guest, Mike Jackson, Executive Secretary Treasurer for the Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. He backs Proposal B. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us, first of all, why you are opposed to Proposal A.
You know, at first glance, you know, a Proposal A is, in our opinion, going to block development. The biggest community benefit that you get out of these developments are jobs. That's first and foremost. And without the development, you have no jobs. So there's always a balance between community benefits and then exactly how much you ask for before the developer decides to move somewhere else. We think that Proposal A goes way too far. We support community benefits agreements. That's why we're supporting Proposal B. We just feel you have to strike that right balance to make sure that the developments continue to come to the city of Detroit.
And when you say go too far, Mike, in what way?
Number one, it removes the mayor and the city council from the process. It's, you know, specifically says that they're not allowed to engage until after the community groups are finished. You know, if you don't have an understanding of the development community, odds are you're not going to be at the table understanding why it is they can or can't do what they're offering to do or saying they can't do. You know, one of the roles we've played for years in Detroit, we've been headquartered here for just about 20 years, is we also invest pension money into certain developments. The job of our real estate experts is to remove any of the unknowns. This proposal puts so many unknowns on the table. They don't have any time limits as to how long it can take. They don't have any limits on what they can ask for. And again, they keep the city council and mayor out of the process. And quite frankly, we feel they've been doing a very good job continuing to bring development to Detroit.
And what is it particularly about Proposal B that you feel merits your support?
Well, again, Proposal B keeps the mayor and city council in the process. They keep the community involvement. You know, the neighborhood advisory council that is working with the arena project right now is going to recommend who will be on it. Detroit City Council and the City Detroit Planning Committee are involved. So they keep the community involvement, but they also keep the mayor and city council involved. Plus, you know, they do raise the bar as far as the size of the development before it triggers. And that's very important, too, because most developers that are on that lower end where Proposal A does catch them, they have a lot smaller margin, if you will. They have a lot smaller room for error.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, when they talk about these proposals, they want to talk about what the city of Detroit is giving in tax abatements, you know, or tax credits to get the development, but they aren't considering the risk that the developer himself is bringing to the table. he's risking $5 million or $10 million, whether it's his own money or money that he's financed, you know, sometimes these are make it or break it decisions on if he's going to do it in the city of Detroit or if he's going to push off to the suburbs.
Mike, the people pushing for Proposal A, such as former Representative Rashida Tlaib, have said they want a stronger voice in developments, in the tax breaks developers get. Let's take a quick listen to Rashida Tlaib.
We have no say about our public health, around noise barriers, around, you know, issues around our quality of life, you know, blight in the community.
How does Proposal B guarantee that residents get a seat at the table so they can have that voice?
Yeah, and first off, you know, I strongly disagree with what she just said, just right at the basic root of it. To say you have no say, your city council and your mayor are elected. And what Proposal A does is remove them from the process and put it in the hands of a non-elected citizens group. So the majority of the citizens of Detroit are better represented by not using Proposal A because they had the opportunity to elect the people that are making those decisions. Whereas in Rashida's world, you know, there's this small group of citizens that weren't even elected that are going to be making those decisions. So you've just taken it out of the hands of one group, giving it to another. That doesn't necessarily make it more representative. You know, Proposal B specifically says who will be appointing these city residents to the board, and they will have a say. So it isn't that these developments don't have community benefits right now, you know, because the city council and mayor have negotiated certain community benefits with these developments. And they've put penalties in, as you've seen on some of the articles that have been out there. So I'd have to say I disagree with that statement.
You've just kind of indicated, and we've heard those of you, all the other unions and those who are opposed to Proposal A, kind of say despite the economic boom in downtown and midtown and other areas of Detroit, developers, their fear is developers would abandon Detroit. Why would they do that, Mike, when the city's arguably in a renaissance and we see investors from all over the world eyeing Detroit really for the first time in decades?
Again, we work with the development community all the time. And, you know, there's a project right now. A lot of times we get approached if there's a hole in funding. You know, a developer has so much money, he's willing to go to the bank for so much. It might be a HUD development, so they have so much money. And then there's this hole in equity. The bank is saying, listen, you need to come up with $3 million more dollars before we're willing to put our money into this. Or HUD is saying, you have to have this much equity in it before we're going to sign on to this project. You add this extra layer of, hey, there's this group of people that before we can even talk to the city about a tax abatement, you're going to have to sit down with. They have no development experience. People will take a look at that and go, look, and I have options. Most developers have options. They can go over 8 Mile. They can shoot off to the suburbs. I think it's a real concern. The developers that we've spoke to have said that, look, if we have to jump through those hoops, we can look elsewhere. There's no community benefits ordinance that we're aware of in the United States that is this restrictive. So people have options when they're spending their money. And again, we want to see the community be treated well. We want to see reasonable community benefits when these developers come into town. But there has to be a balance or they have options to go elsewhere.
What do you say to the Detroiters, many feeling that they have been left by the side of the road for decades by big business and a government that perhaps doesn't have their best interest in mind, that going for Proposal B with the smaller benefits is better for them than Proposal A with the larger benefits. What do you say to those voters?
You know, we went through a huge recession, so there wasn't any growth going on in Detroit for many years. And then now that it has started up, we've put a lot of Detroit City residents back to work just through our organization alone, let alone the combined building trades. There's been a lot of factory jobs that have come back. Manufacturing, we haven't seen manufacturing come back into Detroit in a very long time. If you put something in place that actually stops the development, there is no community benefit. There is zero community benefit if the developer doesn't come. You know, you can ask for anything. You know, you could say at the table, listen, you guys got to build us a water park or we're not going to give approval for you to move forward for your tax abatements. That developer is going to leave. So you have to make sure there's a balance, that you understand the needs of the developers in order to bring them so they bring the jobs with them. that would be what I would say, is that, look, if the developer doesn't come, there is no community benefit. The reason that Detroit has suffered as much as it has is nobody was coming here. Nobody was building manufacturing facilities. Nobody was building arenas or hotels or housing. And all of that is back today, even without an ordinance. And there are a lot of benefits coming to the community because of that development today. So if we're going to do an ordinance and we're going to say it's law, you better make sure that there's a good balance that continues the growth, that those developers say, you know, I can live with those terms. Let's continue to come to Detroit.
Both of Detroit's newspapers, in weighing in on the benefits proposals, the Free Press editorial board said vote no on both. They said Detroiters deserve better than either one. The Detroit News editorial said, well, we don't like B very much, but it's better than A. It seems to be certainly damned with faint praise from the news and the Free Press saying don't vote for either one. What did you think when that came out?
Quite frankly, some of the unions are split in the same way. Some of the unions are saying vote no on both for their own reasons. Some are supporting B like we are. There's a feeling that there is this resurgence in Detroit right now, and that the city council and mayor have done a very good job. And they have negotiated community benefits with these developers. Some people might not think that they negotiated enough, but you have to put yourself in their shoes, right? And see, maybe they understood that if they went much farther, they wouldn't get anything. So the people that are saying no to both are saying, look, we're in this resurgence. Why would we do anything that would get in the way? And then there's those of us who, I mean, in our hearts, we believe in community benefits. We think that Detroit has suffered long enough, and we should get all we can while this development goes on for the citizens of Detroit. The question is, do you ask for too much and the development stops? So I understand why people are saying no to both. We're still supporting B.
Mike Jackson is the Executive Secretary Treasurer for the Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Mike, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Up next, the strange story behind a Boeing 747 once parked at Willow Run Airport, and then a Lansing initiative to expand STEAM education. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's not the kind of aircraft you typically associate with Willow Run Airport. Instead of the two-seater plane or small charter jets, a Boeing 747 was parked there until last year. It belonged to Baltia Airlines. What is a Baltia Airlines, you ask? It's the world's oldest startup airline, and it's never taken a single passenger anywhere. Michigan Radio web producer Menachem Kaiser is here with us now with the bizarre story of Baltia Airlines. And before we talk about how that 747 wound up sitting at Willow Run, tell us, when was Baltia founded and who was the founder?
The airline was founded in 1989 by a Latvian immigrant named Igor Dimitrovsky.
So 1989, so we're looking at almost 30 years ago, and I looked up on their website, on Baltia's website, and it talks about being headquartered at JFK and a base of operations at Willow Run and concierge service and the Golden Rooster Club for first-class passengers. And then I'm going to quote them here. Baltia's goal is to become the leading U.S. airline in the transatlantic market between the major U.S. cities and capital cities of Europe. Baltia will provide high-quality passenger service and reliable cargo and mail transportation. What has actually happened in the 27 years since Baltia was founded?
Not much in terms of taking off. From 1989 till about 2009, they didn't have a plane. So they tried to get this startup airline for about, that was, you know, raising funds, trying FAA regulations. In 2009, they bought that first plane.
The 747, yeah.
Well, that was the first plane. The second plane is the one that was on Willow Run Airport. Mm-hmm. And since then, they failed FAA regulations 7 times.
FAA tested them and they weren't able to...
FAA tested them in Michigan at Willow Run 7 times, and they failed each time.
So they have not taken anybody anywhere in this 27 years.
Oh, they've never sold a seat.
It's a very viable-looking website when you look on it. So... how does a company that people invested in, that you discovered is still raising capital, how do they spend 27 years getting nowhere?
It's a good question. It's a good question. It's a tough question. We don't know. So I didn't speak to any of the Baltia executives. None of them wanted to talk to me. It does seem like they tried. Mm-hmm. You know, they tried. They tried really hard to be an airline. I don't want to take that away from them. But, you know, either through some sort of combination of negligence or kind of ignorance or and bad luck, it just didn't get anywhere. But they raised a lot of money.
Yeah, and had a lot of investors. How much money?
They incurred a deficit from 1989 until today of about $120 million.
And revenue?
Zero.
Zero. Well, then let's talk about this, because as you kind of looked around and tried to get people to talk to you, and as you read the story, it's the top story right now at michiganradio.org, a lot of people didn't want to return phone calls. But you discovered something that you kind of said is the strange world of Baltia shareholders. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So these are penny stock investors. So they're not listed on something like the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. So that there's anything under a dollar. Baltia stock is trading right now at, I believe, 0.0004 cents a share. So these goes on the penny stock, and there's communities that surround this stock and a lot of other penny stocks that are get very fierce, let's call it.
Okay.
The pitch is very high. People are very feverish about that stock. A small fluctuation, if it went to 0.01 cent, suppose, that would mean enormous, enormous change in market value. So there is, in theory, an opportunity to make a lot of money on a penny stock. It doesn't happen very often.
And you found there are people still very much supporting and people who want to hurl mud.
There's a whole community of people who kind of defend it. Some of these, most of them are investors, are shareholders, but they kind of believe that Baltia Airlines is on the cusp of kind of coming through and will still make the money. And like the narrative is very much a, you know, they got screwed over at every turn. They've been faced with bad luck or maybe a corrupt FAA. And some of them still believe that it might make money.
That our day will come. And then what about the other side?
The other side seem to be, they're bitter. I wouldn't even call them cynical. They're just kind of, they've been burned.
Like how much money were people losing?
You know, so I've spoken to people who lost $2,000, and there are people out there who lost millions of dollars. But I spoke to many people who lost tens of thousands of dollars.
And just kind of interesting, just deflated, but not necessarily bitter and angry.
You know, some of the people were, I would call them more knowledgeable investors, and they understood the risks they were taking. But the majority of people I spoke to, you don't know what was going on.
Now, is the founder from Michigan? I guess I'm wondering, how did that 747 wind up sitting at Willow Run?
No, he's from Latvia originally. He immigrated to the States in the 80s. He founded a large dairy distribution company. They ended up in Willow Run. It seems from everyone I spoke to, they suggested that FAA certification would be easier to obtain in Michigan than it would be in JFK.
So there they were. So when did they come to Willow Run?
They moved to Willow Run in like 2010, 2011, okay. I believe.
And then I saw in your story they actually really kind of amped up their presence, promoted the big air show?
Yeah. Within the pro-Baltia narrative, let's say, it seemed that FAA certification was imminent. So once that happened, they seemed on the cusp of becoming a viable international airline. They did have rights. They did have the fly rights to go from JFK to St. Petersburg, which are valuable in its own, a nonstop service. So they kind of promoted themselves. They got a lot of attention. A lot of local people kind of noticed them. A lot of the investors I spoke to are actually from Michigan who were at either the air show or they live near Ypsilanti, and they noticed the 747 and got interested like that.
And said, put some money up. So the idea was, let's go to St. Petersburg. Let's go to some of these underserved Baltic cities.
Yeah.
And yet it's never happened. And the SEC also took notice of Baltia Airlines, did it not?
Yes, very much. The big one was this year in March, the vice president of finance, a man named Barry Clair, was charged by the SEC for illegally pushing stock. So he was acting as a broker, an in-house broker, which is illegal according to SEC.
So what do we have? What's the takeaway besides the fact don't believe everything you see on a company website? Because when you go on that website, it just says, well, we're waiting for FCC certification. But by the way, we have the Golden Rooster Club and we'll have concierge service and all of these great things. But what is the takeaway here?
It's a good question. It's hard to know. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to know with these companies that are kind of so opaque to an investor. And those people will believe, they will cling to their beliefs no matter what. Even when it's their money on the line, that narrative, it lasts. It's a stubborn, very stubborn narrative. But I don't want to be cynical about it. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know the real answers. I wouldn't accuse anyone necessarily. But
it's a bizarre story.
There's belief. And when there's belief, belief is hard to move.
Interesting. Well, you can go to michiganradio.org, and the story is there with some video, photo, some audio, and it does tell quite an interesting and convoluted tale of apparently broken dreams. Michigan Radio web producer Menachem Kaiser, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Such a pleasure.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
The message we've been hearing in Michigan is pretty consistent. Employers are having a tough time filling jobs that pay well, jobs that rely on STEAM skills, science, math, technology, arts, engineering. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is leading the push to make Mid-Michigan's capital region a national leader in STEAM education and fields. Chris Holman is the CEO of the Michigan Business Network, and he's the chair of T3, Teach, Talent, Thrive. Chris, welcome to The Next Idea.
Cindy, thank you for having me on. We appreciate it.
T3 just released a report last week talking about the state of STEAM. What is the state of STEAM in Mid-Michigan right now?
Well, it's kind of interesting when you look at STEAM. And STEAM education, of course, is everybody knows what that was. It started from STEM, and then they threw the arts back in, right? And some of the statistics that we looked at with the STEAM report were graduation rates and the way people are progressing through school, because you can pretty much early on in education, third grade specifically, determine how they're going to do for the rest of their careers. And then we, with the STEAM report, we also wanted to tell people that if you're in the STEAMs and you graduate, retain your degree, you're going to do better. There are placements for you. There are jobs awaiting. There are careers awaiting. So that's kind of made the STEAM report so important to everybody. It was kind of like it was that snapshot, you know, that this is where we're at.
What else are you finding in the state of STEAM report?
We're finding out graduation rates. As a matter of fact, in 2011, were 75% for Michigan high schools. In 2014, they went up to 79. That sounds like pretty good numbers, but it depends if you're trying to stay in the major league with a 300 batting average or if you're trying to do as well as you possibly can, because 79% graduation means 21% are dropping out. And that's a pretty hefty percentage for society to support. So we want more graduates after the high school degree. We want more people going on to baccalaureate or, you know, extensive training, because that's a big part of it here. So we've got a lot of work to do here. And in this area, Clinton County, Eaton County, and Ingham County, Mid-Michigan, you know, we're finding out a little bit that that maybe we're not up to snuff on third grade reading level, which is one of those areas that really kind of dictates, you know, how kids are going to do. Currently in Clinton County, 60%, that's 60% of students in Clinton County are reading at grade level in the third grade, even less in Eaton and Ingham. So 59, 58 in there. And so one of the things we want to do is increase high school graduation rates, and you have to do that by kind of digging deep.
And you're using this T3, the Teach, Talent, and Thrive, to kind of lead this charge. What is T3?
Well, you know, the Teach, Talent, and Thrive, as you said, it's a network of kind of connecting assets to support education and talent development in the capital area, maximizing our chances of real lasting change. In other words, economic vibrance. You know, it's easy to state, and it's statistically supported, that companies and opportunities go where brains are. The most valuable commodity that industry can find, and in industry, I mean all commercial endeavor, are people. And the smarter the people, the more innovative they are, the more entrepreneurial they are, the more they can move your company forward, look at problems, solve problems, find ways to connect with the market. So that's the end game. Are we producing opportunity for the people who are saying you have to graduate to get to that point of opportunity? So this thing evolved from and replaced Keep Learning, which I chaired for about a decade. And T3 actually unites the public and private sectors with the workforce agencies to move the region towards some measurable change. More graduation, kids doing better throughout school, kids going on to, if they don't go on to college, going on to advanced training. And, you know, we have probably, in my mind, oversold the baccalaureate. The advanced training now, in particular, we're finding is every bit as important. I mean, the job opportunities in Michigan right now, some of the top ones are CNC operators. Well, that's manufacturing. That's a job that we can't fill. And welders are in high demand. And we found now, because the number one issue for Michigan businesses is getting and retaining talent, it's actually now stunting growth, that problem of not having talent available. So you've got companies who could be growing, but they can't find the people to fill the positions to allow them to do that.
Chris, to this point of the goal of transforming the capital region, Metro Lansing, into this exemplary STEAM region in the U.S., what makes the Lansing area so special?
Well, of course, that's where we're located. So that's a part of it, right? All right. We also here in the public schools have a superintendent who is very affable to collaboration, working. She's done a great job with bringing the schools up to snuff and now is a big part of the community. And realizing that the continuum of graduation, it's not you give them a certificate of graduation or a diploma and your job is done. She realizes her job is actually to make sure those people then contribute to the community. So that's a big part of it. Another big part of it, I think, in the capital region here is, you know, we're a very stable community, but somewhat transient in that we're the seat of state government. We have tremendous education systems here, you know, one of the largest universities in the country with MSU at 50,000 and the largest law school here with Cooley. We've got a number of other schools here, Davenport. And so we have an education orientation here. And to have public schools in the past turning graduation rates out with 21% failure was just not what we needed to produce what we wanted. So the goal really is to kind of transform Michigan's capital area into an exemplary STEAM region in the U.S., focusing on those fields of science, technology, engineering, arts, and math.
And I'm wondering how you plan to work with the Lansing School District, which, as we know, made national news not long ago, just a few short years ago, when it cut art and music specialists along with physical education in its elementary schools. Anything specific in the works to address that lack of arts in the district?
Yeah, and that's being put back in, by the way. So that's the latest report that you have is arts are actually finding their way more into the school, and it actually is one of part of three trackings that kids who go into school can. School should actually be an area where kids can explore for their careers and their career opportunities. They should get enough exposure to enough things that they can say, you know what, this really geeks me. I want to pursue this. I want to come out. And this is kind of what I want to do. And then they're allowed into one of three tracks here. And they move in different directions. Basics are always covered in all three tracks. But some are arts oriented. Some are language and internationally oriented. And so you give them that opportunity. So the well-rounded education is coming back, and then maybe somewhat, you might say, specializing in certain areas, depending upon your aptitude, your attitude, and a number of other things as students. So, yeah, our school system here now is giving them the opportunity to sample and to choose, which I think is a wonderful thing.
And certainly you're setting up a template that can be followed anywhere in Michigan.
Well, and we hope so, and that's the one thing. It's not about Lansing doing you know, great and going off on their own and being exemplary. It's about us doing this kind of beta test, which we're totally committed to and are sure will work, and then be able to share that, you know, because, we're talking about Michigan, we're talking about the United States. We've got to be great global citizens in an ever-changing marketplace. You've got to not only be prepared for it and educated for it, you have to evolve with it. And to do that, you have to be kind of an innovative, critical thinker.
You can learn more about T3 and also check out the State of STEAM, the newly released report, by going to teachtalentthrive.org. Chris Holman is chair of T3 and the CEO of the Michigan Business Network. Chris, we want to thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Cynthia, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up, how Traverse City became a top destination for world-famous authors.
We could say right away to the publicist, look, we've had really great people here and big audiences, sold a lot of books, so keep them coming. And then they believed us.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Okay, 12 days to go until Election Day. Through these long months of campaign speeches, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes believes both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have missed the mark addressing an issue that's key to Michigan's future. Daniel, you say the candidates and their surrogates are putting out a message that fits the Carter era and not the era of Apple and autonomous vehicles. How so?
Well, I think you get a lot of people talking to particularly blue-collar audiences and saying, you know, we're going to bring jobs back. We're going to essentially go back to the future. And the future's not coming back. You know, technology and has moved in such a way that automakers, for example, can produce more cars than they ever have before with a lot fewer people. A lot of the hires that these companies are trying to make are requiring people to have not only a solid high school education, but in many cases, some degree of post-secondary school training. And in fact, you talk to manufacturers today, to use one example, they will tell you that in some cases, like in the city of Detroit, they have to screen three times as many people to fill, say, 100 jobs because they're trying to find people who are adequately equipped. And I think one of the big lies that is told by politicians, whether it's told locally at the state level or nationally, is that the workforce is ready. And I think in a lot of cases, the workforce is not ready. And here we have business leaders and politicians in Michigan, at least, who are staking the future on being the next hub of mobility, the national, if not international, hub of mobility. Yet we've got public schools whose educational attainment continues to decline.
In fact, in your column, you cite those latest findings from the Education Trust Midwest, and we've talked about them here on Stateside and talked to them, pointing to Michigan's talent crisis, calling our public education system broken. And their findings say Michigan's K through 12 system's among the weakest in the nation and getting weaker. Isn't that really, though, on state lawmakers? They're the ones controlling the purse strings.
Yeah, and I don't want to be misconstrued. I mean, I think I'm writing this piece in the context of the national presidential campaign, but yeah, it absolutely is. And I think the other thing, I've already gotten email today about this and people, you know, pointing and focusing this exclusively on the city of Detroit, and I don't think that's fair. I mean, clearly the city of Detroit's public school system has a lot of issues, and you've talked about them many times on your show. Mm-hmm. I've written about them. But the other thing that the Education Trust Midwest points out is that these problems are not limited to urban school districts like in Detroit and Pontiac and Flint and cities like that, that a lot of suburban districts are having the same kinds of problems in terms of educational attainment. And I think what you have is a lot of parents and just average folks that live outside of those urban areas who kind of smugly sit back and cross their arms and say, not a problem in our community. Well, I think Education Trust Midwest is saying, well, yeah, it is.
Yes.
And you're falling further and further behind. You know, states like Massachusetts, of course, which is the leader, but it's not just Massachusetts. There's an awful lot of other states that are moving ahead. It's not so much that Michigan is getting a lot worse as it is a lot of other places are getting better. And we continue to fight the last war. And I think it's also a reflection to some extent of the culture here. Despite the fact that the car companies are very technologically driven, to use them as one example, or you've got healthcare in Detroit and in Ann Arbor, or life sciences in Ann Arbor and East Lansing, you've got all that stuff going on, you still have an overarching culture here that has not necessarily prized education and higher education for its own sake. And that's a function of the history here. And I think this is not just a policy thing at the level of Lansing and maybe locally, but it also is a cultural thing. And what are the cultural values? And I've long believed that a lot of this begins at home. It begins at the kitchen table. It begins in the values that parents and guardians are setting for teenagers and the people they hang out with.
Well, so as we hear over these long months of campaigning, talk of building walls or rewriting NAFTA or killing TPP, and you point out none of that's going to give more Michigan kids the chance to learn the skills they need for the 21st century economy. What do you think the national level, the presidential candidate's part in all of this should be? Or we should say at this point, the next president.
Well, I know this is heresy to say, but I just wish they'd be more honest about it. You know, we live in a global economy, and I don't think there's any question that in large swaths, particularly in the United States and in parts of Western Europe, you're starting to see some real backlash against globalization. But I think to some extent, it's somewhat misdirected. Are there situations maybe where trade deals have not been advantageous to the local folks? Probably. But remember something. The world has fundamentally changed, and let's use Bill Clinton as an example. It's fundamentally changed since Bill Clinton took office. China came into the global economy. The Soviet Union fell. Eastern Europe opened up. India became a player in the global economy. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, which is when some of these people are kind of conjuring the good old days, half the world was essentially a closed market. And you couldn't compete in American companies and British companies and German companies. In a lot of cases, couldn't compete in those countries. They were untapped markets. Well, now those markets have opened up, and they want to be players, and they are players. And they're not just players from a manufacturing and product standpoint, but they're also educational players. They're sending their people to the United States and to other places to work. And American companies are hiring them in part because they've got the qualifications, the technical qualifications that a lot of American schools aren't necessarily producing.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The National Writers Series of Traverse City hit a really big milestone last week. It hosted its 100th author event. That's quite a mark to hit for something that started in June of 2009. The list of authors that have made their way to Traverse City is impressive. Here with us, Doug Stanton. He's an author and founder of the National Writers Series, and Anne Stanton, the executive director of the National Writers Series and co-director of the Front Street Writers. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Did you always have that idea that you wanted to draw all kinds of writers to Traverse City, going beyond writers who called Michigan home?
Right. So Traverse City's become really one of the top five book tour stops in the country for authors coming out of New York or Los Angeles. And it's just really been an amazing experience. And I think part of that is our audiences keep showing up because they never know what to expect. So we've had Janet Ivanovich, Diana Gabaldon, and George Packer from The New Yorker kind of all in the same season. And my ethos growing up in Traverse City as a young kid here trying to make it as a writer was I want everyone on Main Street to have a book in their hand and be talking about writing. That makes us a richer community.
And I know now there's the reputation when you look at the list on your website of look who we've had. Now people get it. But was it first a bit of a heavy lift to get some of these internationally known writers to say, okay, I'll come to Traverse City?
You know, it wasn't that hard because we started with basically Doug's writer friends who happened to be really famous. And so we could say right away to the publicist, look, we've had really great people here and big audiences, sold a lot of books, so keep them coming. And then they believed us.
And then it becomes a snowball, right? Just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it's been really great.
I want to talk about Elmore Leonard because he really started it for the National Writers Series. You had Elmore Leonard and his son, Peter Leonard. How did you want to make that conversation different from the countless author interviews that someone like Elmore Leonard had done?
Well, you know, I was a contributing editor at Esquire for quite a while, and I worked out of Traverse City traveling around the world, and I always tried to have these very intimate conversations with famous actors. And I think it always worked for me in that I treated them like someone that I already knew, and I was always interested in how I was like them or they were like us, as opposed to how they were a celebrity. So getting on stage with the writer series, it's the same idea. It's kind of like that conversation you have at night. I always imagine a train when you're sitting in a darkened car and you hear this story unfolding behind you in the seat behind you, and you're drawn in immediately just by the simple humanity of it, and you don't know what's going to happen next. And that's what we try to do on stage. So with Elmore, well, in this case, what we just heard was his son, Peter, who is writing and is a successful novelist in his own right. They're talking as father and son. It was a hysterically funny evening. I actually interviewed Elmore again in Traverse City. And I had a second crack at it, and he was one of a kind, that's for sure.
For sure. And as you put the schedule together, is there any kind of master plan in extending invitations to writers, or is it just, oh, look who's available? Yes, let's get this person here.
I try to get a nice mix, you know, somebody funny, literaries, a thriller for Doug, always. That's his favorite. I'm kind of an issue person. I'm a former reporter. So a nice nonfiction book. So yeah, kind of something that appeals to everyone is my philosophy.
Well, you certainly have quite a powerful list of writers who've been there. Tom Brokaw sat down with you in 2010 and was reflecting on the nation during Vietnam. Let's take a quick listen.
Imagine if you're a Marine who's gone through World War II. You dropped out of school in Detroit at the age of 17 and joined the Marine Corps. And then you went to Iwo Jima and you went to Peleliu and you went to Okinawa and you came home. And you married the girl down the street and you went to work for the Ford Motor Company on the line. And you caught the good wave. You got the good benefits, the good wages. Mm-hmm. You got the good pension program. And by the mid-1950s, you bought a house. That was unheard of in your family. And you had two children, a boy and a girl. And they had more things than you ever could have imagined mm-hmm. as a youngster. And before too long, you bought a little fishing cabin in the Upper Peninsula somewhere. And you got a boat to go with it. And you'd spend your weekends coming up here. And then one day in 1967, you come home for supper, as we called it. And it's 5:30 and it's time to watch Walter Cronkite or Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. Still have a crew cut, put your lunchbox down in the kitchen, sit down at the kitchen table and you look up and your daughter is sitting there with hair on her legs because it's not, it's, if you want to be liberated, you don't have to shave your legs anymore. She's not wearing a brassiere or any other undergarments. And she's got a boyfriend who's wearing his sunglasses inside. He seems not to have shampooed or cut his hair in the last 4 years. And his name is Zeke. And he plays in a heavy metal band. And she said, Daddy, Zeke and I are going to move in together, but don't worry about it. I'm on the pill. Now he looks to his son, who's sitting across the table, for some help. And his son is sitting there with an American flag with a swastika over it, with America spelled with a K. And he said, Dad, I'm not going to fight no war in Vietnam. I'm headed for Canada. I'm going to burn my draft card. This old Marine turns around to his wife, looking for some kind of assistance. She's got her hands on her hips behind him, and she says, Hey, big guy, how come I'm the only one who does the dishes around here? That's pretty much a portrait of what was going on in a lot of households in America. Now, having said that, they all got through it together somehow.
Right.
They were able to find their way back together as families, and they all learned from one another. And that's part of the resilient strength of this country, I believe.
Boy, that is a magical moment. You know, you can feel the audience responding. You can feel him just expounding. And you must see this so often. I mean, especially today, you think about where we've gone, where we tend to be a nation tapping on their iPhones and, you know, being in our silos. The idea of getting a group of people together for a conversation, people are hungry for that, aren't they?
Well, just listening to that, Cynthia, I don't often listen to the shows afterwards. And I'm so grateful to Tom Brokaw for writing what he's written and for saying those things he just said. And I'm writing a book about Vietnam right now, and it's just kind of giving me about three different things I should cover in my own book. But this is what we do on stage. It kind of tries to bring history alive, bring current events alive. Thank you for playing that clip. It was really fun to listen to.
Tell us about the initiatives that you've been doing through Raising Writers.
You know, it was actually Doug who came up with our first initiative, which is called Front Street Writers. Doug, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Front Street Writers was inspired by my own experience growing up in town where I didn't have the instruction I needed. And I did find it at a wonderful place called Interlochen Arts Academy and their own creative writing program. Believe it or not, when I was 14, I was a lost geek without direction. I became a geek with direction. The second was a lot more fun. But because of family circumstances, I couldn't continue. So I went back and got a job locally and ended up going back there. But that experience really taught me a lot. Number one, to work and try to save. And two, that people reached down and helped me when I was really needing it. And so when Horse Soldiers became successful, we decided to start our own creative writing program modeled on a no kidding MFA kind of style workshop. And we're doing it. And we've hired a writer in residence from San Diego. We have another publishing poet, Teresa Scollin, who's teaching. And it's for free. It's for credit. And these main stage authors For instance, Tom Brokaw went over to the Traverse City West High School and addressed the entire auditorium of high school students who were interested in lots of things. Typically, the students gather to hear because they want to talk about writing. But I was just so grateful to Tom for doing that. And Lee Child came by the workshop and talked about the Jack Reacher series. We've had all these authors come through. It's not happening anywhere else in the U.S., and it's only because Traverse City is supporting us. What I want to say to everyone listening is you can do this in your own hometown. But it takes a lot of work, and Anna's giving me a look. But you could, if you had the cultural capital, you can marry it with the public infrastructure, and we could all make this a greater experience for our children and for ourselves.
So that's a key thing, is we teamed up with the public school district. And so it was a lot of synergy of, you know, the public school support, we bringing in great writers, finding the money for the writer in residence. It's a lot of work. You don't take this on lightly. And some of the other things, we've got this huge battle of the books that's really fun. We have a scholarship program for writers. We had a poetry workshop for Traverse Heights, where Doug actually went to school when he was a kid.
So you're planting the seeds. You want to get that next generation of writers in. What a wonderful environment for them, knowing that this resource is coming to their town all the time, that there's always authors coming in and out.
Right. So the dream, Cynthia, is in 5 to 7 years, you'll have on one of our former Front Street Writer students with their first novel.
Yes.
And they'll be a guest on Stateside. That will be a happy day.
That is a done deal. What other things do you want to accomplish in the future? And I know, as executive director, you know, what do you see when you look down the road with where you want to take this?
Well, what we've been talking about is taking these shows and putting them on national public radio so that everybody can hear them. They're really, really good. We don't know exactly how we're going to accomplish that, but that's the big dream right now.
What do you want, each of you, this legacy to be? When you think of what you've done with the National Writers Series in Traverse City and where you want it to go, what do you want this legacy to be?
You just heard it in the Brokaw clip, because when I was writing In Harm's Way, my first book about World War II, Tom Brokaw read that manuscript on an airplane unsolicited by me and wrote me this note, which I got in our snowy home in rural Michigan, and it changed my life. And he didn't have to do that. And he didn't have to do a lot of things he's done. And a lot of writers are like that as well. The way I grew up listening to my own father talk about, you always have enough to give somebody something else. And aside from all the fun we get to have writing books and traveling, we live here and we have roots here. I think if much has been given, we have to give back. And so the legacy would be that we've created this thing, and in 10 years, the next generation takes it over. And they learn how to run it, and they learn how to promote storytelling in whatever fashion that's really speaking to them at that time.
Ann Stanton, you get the final word.
Well, you know, I come from more of a reporter, change the world viewpoint, and we bring the brightest people into Traverse City to talk about really big issues. And during this conversation, people think, they laugh, but they do come away transformed by the conversation. You think about the world in a much bigger way, big ideas, and that's what I really love about this whole series.
Doug Stanton, Ann Stanton, congratulations on your 100th author event. Many more to come, and you can get information on their upcoming events by just going to nationalwritersseries.org. Thank you for sharing your vision with us and being with us on Stateside. It was great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.